Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode. Today, we flip the script, and my friend Nathan Hart will be sitting down to host the show, and will be interviewing none other than myself, your regular host, Dave Matthias. At first, I was a little hesitant to do this because the show isn't supposed to be about me, but he persisted. I decided it would actually be a great idea to give you guys some insight into my life, what I do, and why I decided to create this podcast. Without further ado, here is your host, Nathan.
Hi, welcome back to Swimming with Narwhals. This is a very special episode because we are flipping the script. For the first time, our host Dave is being interviewed on his own show.
Hello, everyone. So I'm on the hot seat today.
Yeah. Thank you. Dave and I actually met a few years ago when our daughters Harper and Nora were in the Goddard School at the same time together.
Yep.
So it's a pleasure to do this with you today, especially after a competitive round of mini golf with the girls on Saturday.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I don't know who won, but I think we had three holes in one. And
well, it's hard to tell who'll win if you don't have a scorecard. So that was the key takeaway.
Very fun time, though.
Let's dive into your ambition. I mean, I think you've led a really interesting life so far, and you've traveled a really unique path, and it's taken you to where you are today with the podcast and business ownership. So I'm going to basically kind of dig deeper into your background. So you grew up loving sports, but you took a hard turn into finance after seeing some inspiring videos about the investing world. Yeah, it sounded like you were hooked.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I was in high school, I took a class called Investing and Financing. During high school or even college, play the thing called the stock market game. They give you $100,000 fake dollars to invest in the market. And whoever at the end across the U.S., whoever at the end had the most amount of money got to go onto the floor of the NYSE. Let me tell you, I did not do very well, but from that moment, I was hooked on investing. Whether it was stocks, options, or futures, it did not matter.
Do you remember your return?
Oh, we lost money.
What was your risk strategy?
At the time, we really did not have one. I had a partner. Our strategy was to find a very low price stock in hopes that it would double quickly. Now, I will say the first stock we bought, don't remember the ticker, don't remember much about it, but it doubled very quickly. And we sold, so we had a lot of money, and I think we were in like the top 25 nationwide for the first week or two. And then we got cocky, tried to get another penny stock to double, and that one basically lost, you know, 75-80% of its value over the next 2 or 3 weeks, and we were towards the bottom and never really recovered.
So going full port since the teenage years. Amazing.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about what your finance career would look like once you got into the job market, you know, how quickly did the reality of trade support differ from that original, like, glamorous vision of global stock trading?
My career started off in a very interesting way. Coming out of school, I went to UW-Whitewater in Wisconsin. Got a degree in finance, and I focused my class load on learning how to trade or putting myself in the best position to manage portfolios or trade by taking classes like securities analysis, futures and options, corporate finance. When I was coming out of college, I was looking for a job at either a trading firm, whether it be a market maker in Chicago or a hedge fund in Milwaukee. I found an ad for a options trading firm just a little bit outside of Whitewater. And I was like, oh, this sounds like it could be interesting. So I applied for it. I interviewed with the guy, and he had two other traders. Immediately, we kind of hit it off. And he gave me an offer and said, yeah, let's have you start, you know, like a week or two after school. And I was like, great. At the time, I had a couple other offers from couple other companies, so I immediately turned those down because obviously I wanted to be in the trading environment and not like corporate. Like 2 weeks went by, school ended, And all of a sudden he's like, yeah, I'm sorry. I was doing an analysis and I think adding an extra trader is not going to be beneficial for us and it might actually hurt our profitability. So I'm going to actually have to retract my offer. But in the meantime, I have this hedge fund that I know of in Milwaukee and they're actually hiring someone for trade support. I think you should apply for it because I think you'll probably get it. So I did, and lo and behold, I ended up getting that job at Crable Capital Management. I worked there in the trade support realm for almost 3 years, and I was one step away from being a trader on that trade desk due to downsizing, due to technology, and that sort of thing. I got let go in one of the last rounds of layoffs.
So, Crable, it sounded like you had a really a great time there. Would you mind exploring a little bit more about what you enjoyed?
Sure. Cravel was definitely my favorite job that I had throughout my career so far. It was kind of exactly what I thought I would get into. So it had a trading desk with about 15, 16 traders, something like that, and we had about five support staff working for them, and they traded primarily futures. They also traded FXs, and they traded around the clock. I learned very quickly that it is a very high-paced environment. You really needed to know your stuff quickly because when you're helping out a trader or trying to follow the system, you need to make sure everything is in place at the right time and make sure they know what they're doing and make sure that you have all the available information that they potentially could need. It was, like I said, super fast-paced, and futures trading is just a unique type of trading. The speed at which things went was what attracted me to it, and then also the amount of knowledge that I learned very young in my career, I thought was very valuable. I did enjoy that fast-paced environment, and just being on a trade desk is just something so unique that unless you've been on one, you really can't even describe what it's like.
So being laid off, how are you handling that?
I'm not gonna lie, when I first got laid off, the first thing I wanted to do was apply to as many hedge funds as I could. Like that was my game plan. First, I needed to update the resume, and I was very, very confident, almost cocky at that point in time, and I thought it'd be month, 2 months before I'd have a new job. Just a little background, that was 2009, early 2009, working in finance. If you look back, it's not the easiest time to be finding a job. A lot of these hedge funds, CTAs, were downsizing. I actually took a trip down to the Chicago Board of Trade. I had my resume, I made business cards. And I was talking to anybody and everybody who would come out of the doors to go smoke a cigarette outside the Chicago Board of Trade. And honestly, I thought very quickly I'd get a job. Oh, I was humbled very fast. Everyone down there was pretty much down. They said, everyone's cutting jobs on the floor. The floor is going away. You want to get on an electronic trading desk, all that kind of stuff. So it was a very humbling experience. About 6 months later, I probably applied to hundreds of jobs. Finally went to a job fair and got a job at M&I as a credit analyst.
So you went to the street with resumes and business cards.
Correct.
And so that what you did that more than one time, or that was a one-time thing?
That ended up being a one-time thing. I had an interview down there, and I can't even remember who the firm was, but it was a firm on the floor. We had done a couple phone interviews. First question he asked me was, "Do you know hand signals?" And I said, "No, but I'm pretty sure I can learn them fairly quickly." And he's like, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "No, we need someone who knows it like tomorrow. So I'm sorry for wasting your time. And we can talk a little bit more, and I can give you practice with interviewing or whatever. And I was like, okay, well, thank you for your time, but I think we'll just call it there. And yeah, because I already knew at that point I was headed over to hand out resumes and business cards. So one opportunity down, another opportunity could be knocking any second. So I went down there, and I literally sat there for probably 2 hours trying to talk to people, and unfortunately, nothing came of it, but I grinded, man. I was really trying to find something that would fit what I was looking for.
That's a real grind.
Yeah, people did call me crazy, and yeah, I think I still have a business card or two. I'll try and dig those up, and I'll put them on my Instagram.
Well, good for you. So then you went to the job fair and you found your next role.
Correct. Yep.
You hated it immediately.
Yeah, it did not suit me or my style at all. It was just paper pushing. It said credit analyst on the role, so I figured I'd be, doing some analyzing of companies or businesses, things of that nature. But honestly, that's what the business bankers were doing. And then they were giving us all that information, and then we would be putting it in a loan presentation that they had already filled out, and we were just filling in certain parts that they needed filled in. Very quickly, I learned that the typical 9 to 5 with your hour lunch, your whole day is planned out. You have 4 hours to do one loan presentation, and then you have to sign that off, and then do another one. Like, nah, that was not for me. It was too slow. It was too bureaucratic. It was like it needed to be a library in there. Like, you couldn't talk to your neighbor. It was just like, what is this? Like, I needed to get out as soon as possible.
And at that time, had entrepreneurship ever crossed your mind?
No, not at all. It was basically, I need to get back into the futures trading industry in some way, shape, or form. This career path that I'm currently on is not going to work for me. Decided at that point in time, Milwaukee, which is where I called home for 25 years, I had to leave. Like, there just wasn't enough there in a job industry that I wanted to be in. And so I had to decide to make the move to Chicago.
You had to find the job at NewEdge and then you moved to Chicago.
Correct. So I had lined up, I mean, I had a number of job interviews between, I want to say, September and mid-November. I was interviewing at a fund of funds. I interviewed at investment banking at Bank of America. There was an actual like stock analyst job at Bank of America. And then throughout this whole process, I had learned about a trader group that met in Chicago about once a month. I think it was called Traders Fulcrum. And I decided to show up to one of their events again with my resume and business cards. I just started talking to anybody and everybody at the event. I met a guy who traded on the FX desk for BMO at the time. It was just Bank of Montreal, it wasn't BMO Harris. He's like, "Well, I know a couple guys down here that work for a couple clearing firms, and why don't you send me your resume and we'll go from there." And about 2 weeks later, he had a job opening doing futures and options clearing on the EMEA markets for a firm called NewEdge. They were starting to build out their Follow the Sun program. And I was like, okay. I applied for the job, and the manager was immediately like, "Yeah, come on down. I don't even need to waste my time, waste your time on a phone interview. Come on down and we'll see what happens. When are you coming next?" I was like, "I'm not planning on coming next, so when do you want me to come?" We decided, I think it was like the following week, I interviewed with him and the manager over in London, pretty quickly, within like a half an hour, she's like, "Yeah, when are you going to come over to London to learn the job?" And I was like, "Whoa, okay, well, I mean, got a couple steps before that, but okay, I think I know where this is going." About a week or 2 weeks later, we were negotiating, a contract or whatever. And at the time, I had received a contract from that hedge fund of funds, the NewEdge job, and the Bank of America analyst program. The problem was the analyst program was put on hold. And so I was like, well, I'm not going to wait. And then it was just a decision, do I want to work for the fund of funds or do I want to work on the clearing side? Now, the fund of funds job was more just running spreadsheets for the portfolio managers. And at the time, I was like, I don't think I'd like that because it kind of sounded similar to what I did at M&I. So I took the NewEdge position and, moved to Chicago in the winter of 2011. And then from there, I worked there for 4 years. And I did really like the job there. I liked the team. I liked the job, fast paced, dealing with hedge funds. Even though I'm on the clearing side of things, really fun job. After 4 years, the industry started outsourcing everything. So I kind of saw, like, okay, they're going to start downsizing. I need to find another out. I need to find a new job where I can, get in, where I can find lasting career path, which led me to a company called Harris Associates. And that's an investment management firm here in Chicago. And I worked there for, I believe, like 7 years.
And now, while you were at Harris, this is where you were on call 24/7, 1 week a month.
Yes. So I did actually do two jobs there. The first job I did, I was on the post clear team, ensuring that the trades that we basically as a company executed were matched, and it was all just post trade clearing stuff, which was a great entry into Harris Associates and my time there. After 2 years, I moved on to a team that supported the portfolio managers, supported them in any way that they needed, and that did include being on call 24 hours a day for 1 week every month.
And how often would they call you?
Fairly often, yes. Katie would joke, one of the portfolio managers, he always seemed to put multiple orders a night. And he would do it multiple times during that week whenever I was on call. But it sure didn't seem like they showed up as much when the others were on call. So we always kind of laughed at that when I'd get the 11 o'clock followed by the 1:30 call. And then that was, pre-work from home at all. Since we lived pretty far away from the city, I'd be waking up at 4 a.m. so I could get to work by, before 7. So you're on about 2 or 3 hours of sleep and, up at 4, get down to the city at 7 and, make your way through the day.
Let's talk about the incredible feat of endurance. So
Let's
you
do
went
it.
from a tough triathlon to completing the Ironman Wisconsin in just 4 years.
Yep, that's
Tell
right.
us about
All
that.
right. As you kind of mentioned at the beginning, sports was always a big part of my life. I played soccer, baseball, basketball growing up. Once I got into college, I played, intramurals, soccer, volleyball, basketball. And then when I graduated, I did play 1 year of softball in Milwaukee, but like it just wasn't the same. Throughout the beginning, I would try to get people I worked with to play basketball, like after work. It did kind of work for a little bit. We had at M&I, we had a bunch of guys who would play 3-on-3 like every Monday or Wednesday. When I moved out to Crystal Lake, I started riding with a group of people that We'd bike from here up to Lake Geneva and back. And it was like 70, it averaged like 75 miles. And a couple people in that group were triathletes. So I was like, oh, maybe I could do that. Obviously, the first thing, let's see if I can swim. I haven't really swam in years. Let's try this. And when I started, I couldn't even go four lengths of the pool without stopping. Like, it was pretty embarrassing. I had a first thing I did was I bought a book on how to swim. So I quickly learned how to swim. Honestly, that became like almost relaxing, just swimming in the pool back and forth, back and forth. It was very calming. It was very peaceful to me. In a crazy, insane world with, the work stress, stress at home, that sort of thing, like getting into the pool and just swimming was very calming. Like, okay, maybe I can add a run after my bike. Okay, I can do this. All right, let me try a sprint triathlon. So I signed up, I can't even remember, 2012, I believe. There's a triathlon right in my backyard, just next town over. And I did it, and it was not pretty. It was super ugly. It was very challenging. And I was like, wow, I don't know if I'll ever do this again. Following morning, yeah, I think I need to start finding some other triathlons to do. My ultimate goal, I guess, was to do a half Ironman, to build up to do a half. So that year I did two sprints. The next year the plan was to do a sprint and an Olympic. And depending on how I felt after the Olympic, maybe I'll do a half. So I did the Olympic. Man, that was brutal too. But at the time, I wasn't really putting enough effort into my training. So it was like part-time. But as I signed up for the first half Ironman, that's when things started to get real and started to like really start clicking. Like, okay, maybe I should put in a little bit of effort and see how it goes. I did that first half Ironman in 2015. And again, after I finished, I was like, okay, I'm not doing that again. That was tough. That was very tough. Woke up the next morning, felt a little better. 2 days later, started getting text messages from some friends who had done the full Ironman. Was like, I think you have to do it. And I was like, I think I have to as well. And so lo and behold, in 2015, I volunteered for the Ironman Wisconsin 2015. So that would put me first in line to sign up for the full Ironman in 2016, because back then it sold out every year. It doesn't do that anymore. So that's when I signed up to attempt my first Ironman in 2016. And that's when I really started taking things seriously. I had a training program, and I actually did swimming drills, swimming camp, where it really drilled down on your form and make sure everything's efficient. Yeah, I learned a lot doing that. I took the running a little bit more seriously as well, and yeah, lo and behold, 2016 is when I did my first Ironman, and I finished it first try.
That's incredible. You could probably fill a whole podcast episode just talking about triathlon bikes and bike equipment.
Oh God, yeah. Absolutely. That's one of my favorite topics. And you talk to Katie, she'll just walk out of the room shaking her head. She's like, I don't want to even start. Because she knows it'll go on for a very long time.
So you sound like you were making pretty significant strides and progress in your triathlon. So, was there any aspiration to just continue to push yourself to the fullest extent of your capabilities?
Absolutely. After 2016, I did what a lot of triathletes do, and they took a year off from the full, just because doing a full Ironman takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of training, a lot of practice. After doing it for 9 months full-time training, I was like, I need to take a little bit of a break. That didn't mean I wasn't going to do any triathlons, let's be honest. In 2017, I did two half Ironman races. I did the one in Madison and I did the one in Racine. My times, every single race I did, I PR'd. So every single race that I did the Ironman Wisconsin a number of times, or I'm sorry, Ironman 70.3 Wisconsin a number of times. Every single time I raced it again, I got another PR. I did the Lake in the Hills triathlon probably four or five times. Every single time it was a new PR. So I started seeing really, really good results. And my running, which was kind of my biggest attractor, I think, in the 2016 Ironman, I really started to focus on that. I did sign up for a marathon in 2017 as well. And with very minimal training, I finished a sub four marathon, which was my goal. So I was, or actually, that was one of my goals, which I was very happy about. I thought I could pull a 3.5 hour marathon. The gods were not with me that day. It was very hot, and I fell behind the pacer around like mile 14 or 15, and then I stubbed my toe around mile 18 or 19. I knew it was bad right when it happened, because I never felt a pain like that in my toe. And when I crossed the finish line and finally sat down, I took my shoe off, and the whole toenail was black and blue and was bleeding. So yeah, it was, I don't know what I kicked, but it hurt.
What are the distances of the three disciplines of an Ironman?
An Ironman is 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike, and then a 26.2 mile run.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very intimidating.
So it sounds like you also started working with a coach.
After the 2017 season, I was feeling really good. I finished. Now, Ironman does this thing called All World Athlete. And so, anybody who finishes in the top 10%, you get the top three finishes throughout your entire season. Most people only do like one or two races. So, like, the more races you do, the more points you accrue. But basically, those two races that I did, I finished solidly in the top 10%. And I ended up getting the All World Athlete. I became an All World Athlete that year. That gave me the confidence to sign up for the 2018 full Ironman. And I thought, I've done all this on my own, no coach, just ambition and practice. Let's get a coach. Let's see where I can go from here. My coach, she's a fantastic coach. She definitely knew what she was doing. Her athletes all are top performers. I was super excited for 2018 season to start, and basically it unraveled right as I started training. It fell apart real quick.
So when you say it fell apart, was it an injury? What, can you go into that a little bit further?
Yeah. Little did I know at the time. So I started training on the bike really hard, running intensity like I've never seen, and then swimming kind of as well. And swimming used to be like my peaceful time. And in the pool, my legs would start cramping all the time. I'd push off the wall and it'd just be like a cramp. I don't know. Most people probably have never tried to swim with a cramp, but it's nearly impossible. It's so hard. It's so painful. And I was like, what? What is going on? And this was like, I mean, I started training in February, and by the end of February, this was happening. And I was thinking to myself, like, what am I doing wrong? Pretty much right away, I was like, well, I don't know what to say, but I have to stop training because, like, my legs hurt. And she's like, yeah, take a break. It'll just take a little bit and you'll be able to get back into it. But that was just the beginning of a very long journey to trying to find what the hell was going on with me.
Would you mind walking us through maybe the first few steps of that journey?
Sure. You know, like anything, you start with finding a specialist that maybe has dealt with this sort of thing in the past. There was a doctor in Chicago that, one of the doctors on the course at Ironman Kona. And so I was like, oh, this would be a great person to start. And so we were just ticking boxes, checking some things, talking about diet. Thought I was not having enough protein. We were going to just start going heavy protein diet, see if that helped over the next week or two. So started that and didn't do anything. We did a quick little ultrasound on my calves, and it looked like there was a little bit of tendonitis, which maybe a little bit of PT, continue your diet, and you should be back in no time. So I did some PT. A month went by. It's actually, things are getting worse. That's obviously not it. This was actually the same time period where Katie was pregnant. And so not only was I trying to get this one last Ironman race in before I had a child, this was also kind of the time period where I was thinking to myself, like, is this kind of what I want to do with my career? Do I want to be on call 24/7 with, you know, a young kid? So a lot of things were going on. One of the main focuses was like, I need to get this figured out before my child comes along. Needless to say, that did not happen. So Harper was born in June of 2018, and I actually switched physical therapists. So I changed it from one in the city to one out in the suburbs. And when I did that, they're like, oh, it's not your legs that are the problem. It's something in your back. And so I was like, oh. So then they suggested I go to a different doctor. We start checking that area out a little bit. Then I started having I had a couple MRIs. I had an EMG trying to get to the bottom of what it could be in my back that's causing this problem. Well, three MRIs, EMG, back injection, nothing worked. Pain's getting worse. So they finally put me on gabapentin to try and soothe the pain, because I mean it was getting to like pain levels where it was kind of hard to even get to work, like take the train to get downtown, because my legs would just throb as I would sit on the train. That's not sustainable long term, right? So trying to figure this out. So the back injections didn't work, all the PT I did didn't work. So they suggest I go to a different doctor at the Ability Lab, because the Ability Lab down in Chicago is like one of the best clinics with, like, you know, best doctors, best physical therapists, you know, top-notch talent in that area of the world. The doctor there was like, all right, let's do some physical therapy. And he explained basically the physical therapy I was going to do. And I said, I've already done all that. And he's like, no. We're going to do it again. He's like, I have to knock this out first. And I was like, okay. So I did a month and a half of physical therapy. Didn't improve. He's like, okay, thank you for checking that box. What else can we do? And I was like, I don't know. So at the time, I'm listening to a Lance Armstrong podcast about the Tour de France. It's like 6 o'clock in the morning as I'm taking the train in. I'm waking up at 4. So like I kind of half listen to the podcast as I go in and out of falling asleep and not falling asleep. But I get the gist of the podcast. And all of a sudden he's talking about Steven Kruijswijk, who is a cyclist, who is, you know, a top cyclist in the Tour de France. He's talking about an injury he had. And he's talking about how his legs hurt, how they cramped a lot. He continued on a little bit. And in my groggy state, I was like, hold on a second. And I backed up the podcast and I listened to it again. Everything Lance had said, it was like, check, check, check. That's me. I immediately knew what it was, which was external iliac artery endofibrosis, which is basically a blood flow issue to your legs. Blood's not getting down there. And I knew immediately. I had a doctor's appointment literally the following day. So right when I got to work, I sent him an email and said, I know exactly what it is. This is what I have. Let's talk about it. He goes, no, you don't have that. That was his reply to my email. And I was like, well, we're going to talk about it tomorrow. So I printed out, all the research that I had read throughout that day. And I 100% knew that's what I had. And so when I went to his office and we started talking about it, he's like, I'm going to be honest with you. I wrote a report on this when I was in school. And I immediately was like, what? You know about this? And we didn't even talk about this? So I was, pretty frustrated at that point. And he's like, I still don't think you have it, but let's order you the tests and let's figure it out. And I was like, okay, whatever I have to do. And so he ordered the first test. So there's three separate tests you can take. One is a simple run test, and then they measure your blood flow. When I got to Northwestern to test that, they wouldn't even let me run. So I was like, well, this isn't going to work. Like, I'm not even, getting moving. And so failed that test. I didn't fail the test. It just came back normal. Then there was another test in between where I think they took x-rays or they did something of that nature. That came back negative as well. And then there was an invasive one where they push fluids into your arteries, and then they're able to take pictures of your arteries as they're flushing this fluid through. And sure enough, test came back that I had external iliac artery endofibrosis on both sides, and there were kinks and buildup on both arteries. And immediately the doctor's like, yeah, you were right. And at that point I was like, okay, now I know I'm on my way to recovery. And it's funny because the other doctor told me to call him when I got the results. And so I called him and I left the message. And when he called me back, he's like, it was funny because I had him on speakerphone, and he's like, I cannot fucking believe you were correct. And then we both kind of laughed. And at that point, I knew I was kind of on my way back to recovery.
I don't know if that was what you went through is not funny, but the way you delivered the conversation between you and the doctors was hilarious. I was actually cracking up almost the entire time you were telling that story.
Yeah, I mean, I look back at, it was so brutal, mentally just extremely difficult to go through, not knowing if you're gonna be okay. I mean, the pain levels were no joke. It was very uncomfortable. I was on an insane amount of gabapentin to deal with it. And it's funny too, because every time I went to a new doctor and they're like, you're on how much gabapentin? I'm like, yeah, it's a lot, I know. And they're like, no, that's a lot. And I was like, yeah, trust me, I know.
Oh, that's funny.
But yeah, so eventually the doctor who verified the test did the surgeries, and they're back to back. When I say back to back, had one surgery 1 month, had a whole month to recover, and then second surgery happened, full month to recover. I had those surgeries in November and December of 2019, and I returned to work mid-January of 2020.
Recovering from physical surgeries, it's not just physical recovery. There's also a mental part of the recovery. So how did you, there's a lot that you went through, your intense training, kind of have to drop it all in serious pain, tons of gabapentin. How did you address the mental part of the recovery?
Well, it's interesting because so after surgeries, I mean, I felt really good. My legs did. That was until I went back to work. As soon as I went back to work, it kind of started coming back again, but not at a level where it was before. Like before, it was unbearable. There's just no way through. Now it was just like, I just want to say it was like lingering, right? It was like, put it on a pain scale of like 1 to 10, it'd be like a 2 or 3. And I was like, okay, so I was trying to figure out like what else it could be. So I talked to my surgeon. He was like, oh no, it's just your body recovering. It takes over 6 months for like your full body to recover. Let's give it time. So we gave it time, and that really didn't help much. So then I started thinking, well, what else could it be? And then when you start, I got the first one right. So I was like, what else could it be? So I started asking a couple other doctors that I had seen along the way. They're like, well, there's a couple other things we can explore. One of them was I did a test that measured the pressure in my legs, and the pressure was like off the charts. Like it was super high. And when the pressures are that high within your calf muscles, that it basically indicates you need to have a fasciotomy or a fasciectomy. So that's what they suggested. And I was like, okay, let's do it. That's probably what it is. Had that surgery about 8 months after I had the second surgery, and went to physical therapy, and that didn't help. So, like, mentally, I thought I had everything fixed, but in actuality, I did not. And so then I just kept searching and searching. The fasciotomy didn't necessarily work either. It was successful, but it didn't work for fully recovered, no pain. So then I talked to that surgeon, and I talked to her PA, and they suggested one other thing, which was called a gastroc recession, which is basically they cut the bottom of your calf muscle in an effort to extend it to relieve some pressure off of your calf muscles. And I thought that was like, okay, this is gonna be it. And the doctor basically said, yeah, I think this is gonna fix it, but we'll find out fairly quickly. Now, that surgery was actually the worst of all the surgeries I had. There were days where I couldn't even move my leg to walk. It was a pretty brutal recovery. And shortly thereafter, I was, fully recovered from like the normal pain of surgery. I realized that that didn't work either. So I'm kind of stuck here trying to figure things out. And right at that time period, my manager, I was at Harris, like I said, for 7 years. My manager that was at NewEdge, he had moved to a new firm, and he had said, we're kind of onshoring everything that we had just offshored. Would you like to build this team? And I was like, this might be a good opportunity to restart, start again, and maybe I can get things moving in the right direction. So I was like, yeah, let's do that. I started that new job, kind of went back to that doctor that didn't believe me that it was EAIE, and said, what can I do? What can we do? And he sent me to the pain clinic at the Ability Lab. This is like the end of the line type deal. Like, if this doesn't work, then this is just how you're going to have to deal the kind of the rest of your life. So I was on the part-time program for 2 months, where I would go 4 hours 2 days a week, and you'd go to a physical therapist, occupational therapist, and do like meditation and a couple other type relaxing type things. When I kind of started that, like it was very weird to kind of sit there in the meditation hours, and my mind would just be going nuts, thinking about job, thinking about my daughter, thinking about how I'm not competing anymore. And there's just like crazy, like tons of thoughts floating around, and they teach you to kind of quiet that out. And throughout that 2 month program or whatever, like I started really kind of meditating and getting into that sort of thing, and taking time for myself and taking time to just relax. When I started getting into the therapy stuff, it became kind of clear that I was just trying to do way too much all at one time, and this was my body's way of telling me, shut it down. Now, granted, the thing that's a little bit different was I actually did have a serious problem, but then I also had all the other things going on at the same time. So that is what kind of really set my path to kind of a full recovery. Maybe not full, I shouldn't say full because I'm still not fully recovered, but on my way back to kind of normalness. And normal is a terrible term, I shouldn't use that, but more back to what I would consider my normal life.
Yeah, your baseline.
And a lot of this theory that I just talked about being all too much, this was all predicated, and I figured a lot of this out when a book was given to me called Healing Back Pain by Dr. Sarno. As I read that book, kind of how I listened to that podcast, I knew that they throughout the book they were describing me. If any of you out there that have chronic pain or are dealing with chronic pain and haven't found a solution, I really suggest checking that book out. It's a very short read, and you'll figure out pretty quickly whether or not it suits what you're looking for. And I saw myself all throughout that book.
During the time that you were investigating your pain, it sounds like you weren't able to maintain an active lifestyle. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty difficult, to be honest. I kind of started digging deep into like, what else can I do? So I started listening to a lot of different podcasts on like side hustles, or there was one, I think it was called like Million Dollar Idea. I just started racking my brain with like different things I could do to, kind of get a little bit of extra income on the side. Or I was listening to one of those podcasts. One of the guy's ideas was dog socks. I can't even remember the amount of dog socks he sold. It's in the hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars worth of socks. And I was like, oh my God, I don't want to leave the triathlon life. Maybe I can create socks with people's like pictures from the races, and I'll call it selfie socks. And eventually I came up with the idea of the original selfie sock. I came up with this idea of March 2020. And we all know what happened in March of 2020. All of a sudden, I was like, all the races and all the things that I had planned on being there for and attending and supporting kind of shut down. And so I was like, oh no, what can I do now? At the time, masks were kind of in short supply. The provider that I had chosen and did all this research into for socks started offering masks. So I bought a bunch of those, started making a couple for myself and family. Yeah, I got a couple pretty decent orders there, and that kind of helped that business start. Kind of been running that business since then on the side. I love making socks, and the sillier the better. I love making, socks with some crazy pictures of people. Dog socks too. Like that's something that I make a lot of, and it kind of brings out a little bit of creative side in me. Honestly, I thought it would be bigger than I ever got, than I ever got it, but that's okay. I learned a lot through that process of starting that company. That kind of helped when an opportunity recently came into my life when my wife had the opportunity to buy the company that she was working for.
Well, I can't wait to get into that, and I will say that my custom pair of Dave Mathias socks are in regular rotation.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
They're very comfortable.
And by the way,
So this, yeah.
if you want the pair that Nathan has, I still definitely make them. They are the Bitcoin sock. They are one of the, I've sold a number of those pairs, and they're definitely in my rotation as well. They're one of my favorite ones to wear.
Would you like to elaborate a little bit about this business that you are now an owner of?
I am personally not an owner of, technically, I guess I am. My wife worked for a staffing firm in Crystal Lake for, I think it's been 14 years. They worked for the same owner for the whole time, and it's just a very small company. There were about 8 to 10 employees of the firm for the whole time she was working there. And they've had the business for a number of years. It's a 45 or 46-year-old business and a staple in Crystal Lake and helping the light industrial and front office help. A number of other things as well, but their main client was light industrial, and so they wanted to retire. They were looking to sell. As they announced this to their employees, Katie and her coworker kind of started talking like, "Hey, do you think this would be a good idea to buy the company?" Of course, me being someone who's wanted to get into owning a business, just needing to find the right business, which is easier said than done. I saw this as a great opportunity to buy a business. Jess and Katie know the business front to back pretty well. There were a lot of things we did not know before we bought it, but like we just figured, well, let's figure it out. So we basically went through all the financials and tried to figure out if we could make it work. We kind of just all were like, yeah, let's do it. Like the worst that can happen is we lose our investment, we lose all of our capital invested. If it doesn't work, we won't be bankrupt, but we also wouldn't be in a great position. But the upside is there. The upside was so much higher than the downside. So just doing that quick, back of napkin math made complete sense. And so yeah, we decided to go forward and we bought the business at the end of 2024.
Well, congratulations, and we will definitely need a follow-up episode with your progress.
Thank you. Yeah, they're definitely on the plan of people to be interviewed. So stay tuned because Jess and Katie will be guests of this podcast in the near future.
Speaking of this podcast, let's talk more about swimming with narwhals. So tell us about it.
So
What's the story behind it?
I've always wanted to do a podcast for as long as I can remember. The problem was at one of my older employers, they didn't allow it. That kind of stopped everything in its tracks. So I'm not allowed to do it if I am an employee of that company, which I completely understand. I waited, and honestly, there's been so many ideas that I've had after thinking of different ideas, all the dynamics of having multiple people and that sort of thing. I thought my favorite podcasts were of interviews of successful people. Million Dollar Idea, Mind the Business, which was one of the ones that I really liked, where they're talking to entrepreneurs. What I wanted to focus on was like more like the everyday person who took a risk and was successful. And I want to hear their story, how they got there, and see if there's any leads I can follow in their story to kind of help me in my progress to get a business, or now that Katie owns a business, to help her business, to see that there are really a lot of people out there that are taking that risk and that are successful. Their stories need to be told. And it's funny because I ask these people to be on the podcast, and a lot of people at the beginning are like, I don't know, my story's not very good, or I don't know, like, who wants to listen to me? Well, I do, first and foremost, and that's kind of the first thing you need to do. You need to make it for yourself. And then if it's entertaining for you, hopefully through that, it's also entertaining for other people. I honestly think everybody has a story to tell. If you are very passionate about something, those are the kind of stories I want to hear because they have the enthusiasm. And maybe, just maybe, there's one thing that one question I ask that someone answers that sparks someone's interest in something, and then they go and start a business or something like that. Yeah, I think everyone has a story, and kind of like you, I didn't think I would be telling my story, and here we are. That's kind of the thought behind that. And then the title, like I went through tons of different titles and ideas. Like one of the ones I wanted to be like Living the Dream or Swimming with Sharks, you know, something like that. And then all of a sudden, I don't know if it was Katie or who said, like, how about Swimming with Narwhals? It's just different, unique. And I think with the logo that my friend created, I really do love the logo. And so I just love it, and it fits. And literally, Swimming with Narwhals could talk to anybody, which is basically what I want to do.
That's great. Yeah. So everyone has a story to tell. And so by now you've interviewed a wide array of founders and builders and everyday people. So what would you say is maybe one of the more valuable pieces of insight that you've learned and you've applied towards your business ventures?
Oh man, it's very simple. It sounds simple, but very difficult. You have to do something that makes you happy. The people that I've interviewed, all of them, it's not really a job for them, right? Like it's a job and they do it really well and that's how they pay their bills, but they are happy and they like doing it. And honestly, that's kind of what's always been missing in like my career. Maybe not at the very beginning, but like as it's evolved, this avenue it's been very fun, and I've really enjoyed it. So I'm gonna continue getting these episodes out because I think it's important.
Dave, thank you. This has been a fantastic look behind the curtain at your journey from the trading floor to the Ironman course and ultimately to the microphone.
I love it. Well,
Yeah,
thank you.
thank you for sharing. Yeah, and so, to wrap it up, is there one final question you wish I'd asked you today?
You know what? I don't think there's any question really that I would have liked you to ask, but I guess I'll finish the way that I finish all my interviews. So I guess maybe that's it. Like this is my message to the listeners. You have to do what makes you happy and just be yourself. Like a lot of jobs and things, people get all caught up in the, oh, I need to look this way or I need to act this way. Otherwise, I'm not going to get a promotion or I'm not going to be able to follow this career path. I definitely fell into that trap. And honestly, that's a way to become unhappy. So really, you just have to be yourself and find something that makes you happy. Otherwise, life is so short. We have to make the most of it.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Nathan. I really appreciate it. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun being on the other side of the microphone.
My pleasure.
All right, guys, until next time. Bye, y'all. Thank you for taking the time to hear my story. If you ever want to dig further into any of the things I discussed today, hit me up, as I could go on for a lot longer. I want to give a special thanks to Nathan for having the idea to interview me, because I couldn't have done it without you. If you like this episode, please subscribe, and if you have the time, please leave a review. Thanks again. Bye, everyone.